Well, hello again to everyone. My name is Paul Weber, and I am very pleased to be able to finally welcome you to the Pregnant Healthcare Worker and Infection Risk. We've tried to bring this teleclass to you twice before. We were foiled by the quirks of modern communications technology and then, ironically, by infectious disease itself, but we're nothing if not persistent. Our lecturer today came very highly recommended by other members of the teleclass faculty. Dr. Sotirios Theodorou, pardon me if I get that wrong, is a professor and lecturer at the University of Athens Medical School. In my research, I found no fewer than 68 articles on which his name is listed as author, and he is a peer reviewer for the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. He is a highly respected expert, and these days he is a very busy man with Greece's pandemic response. I'm very pleased, and in fact, I'm very honored that he's able to make this time for us today. So to bring us the teleclass, the Pregnant Healthcare Worker and Infection Risk from the University of Athens, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Sotirios Theodorou. Dr. Theodorou.
Good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to talk to you from Greece. It's 8:30 p.m. here in the evening, and today we had our 31st case of novel influenza AH1N1 in Greece. We're still in our containment efforts, although I think they're futile. Anyway, our subject is a very, very interesting subject, and it concerns pregnant healthcare workers and the risk of an infection. And as you will see in my presentation, sometimes the risk is not that different from the risk a pregnant lady has that's not a healthcare worker. But in some aspects, we have some differences. Of course, there's a special concern as we look through our first slide for pregnant healthcare workers and infection risk, since some certain mild infections may potentially affect the development of the fetus. Next slide. Some of the problems that we encounter when we look at this issue globally is the risk assessment, and that's performed by the physician examining the healthcare worker. And the risk assessment is first to detect the infectious agent, then to ask yourself about the mode of transmission and the kind of contact that exposed the healthcare worker to the infectious agent. And last but not least is the stage of the patient, the stage of the pregnancy, which sort of has is very, very important in determining the probability of transmission of the infectious agent from the pregnant healthcare worker to the fetus. Moving forward with the risk assessment, there's some factors that pertain to the healthcare worker herself, such as the personal predisposition to infection, and thus the physician evaluating the healthcare worker needs to have a complete access to the medical record, to the history of any previous infections, the immune status of the patient. Thus, immunization records are very, very important. Moving to the next slide, our risk assessment also pertains to the risk after exposure. So what happens after the exposure to the healthcare worker, and what's that risk? Moving to the next aspect of the infection risk is the interventions that we physicians have to do and our response to an incident of a pregnant healthcare worker reporting an infection. And sometimes it's really simple measures like hygienic measures, measures pertaining to personal hygiene. Then we have preventive measures, such as the administration of a globulin or a vaccine. Of course, the sharing of information with the healthcare worker, which in my opinion is one of the most important factors in dealing with this issue, and lots of discussion is usually necessary with the healthcare worker regarding the issue of infection and the transmissibility of that infection to the embryo. And usually, but not always, you need to call in an infectious disease physician to consult with him and have more specific guidance regarding difficult problems. An essential part of the response to the incident is the laboratory testing, and you need to know the value of your tests when testing a pregnant woman. The immediate management in some more serious cases, and the follow-up to see whether seroconversion happened after the exposure to the infectious agent, whether the immunoglobulins levels rose to a level signifying exposure and seroconversion to the agent, and of course the probability of the transmission to the fetus. For example, one can see here in the following slide that young women who are susceptible to rubella, because most of us get vaccinated against rubella in our young ages, are in the range of 1 to 2%, whereas for parvovirus B19, the percent of young women that show susceptibility is anywhere from 40 to 50%. And when one looks at the infectivity risk for household contact, it's extremely high for rubella and chickenpox, but it's a medium risk for parvovirus. Then moving to the next row, you see that the risk of fetal infection depends on the stage of the pregnancy. For example, for parvovirus B19, it can go up to 70% if you're more than 16 weeks ahead in your pregnancy. Whereas for chickenpox, if you're less than 28 weeks pregnant, the risk of fetal infection is really, really low. And then again, the risk of fetal harm is another different parameter, as you can see in the last row. For rubella, if it's in the early stages of pregnancy, it's extremely high, close to 90%. Whereas in chickenpox, if it's less than 13 weeks of pregnancy, it's 1%. So these are important factors. And moving to the next slide, you see that the risk to the mother also is different. And for example, for chickenpox, you can have a very bad pneumonitis, and you need to intervene to give the specific immunoglobulin to the mother and the neonate that attenuates the illness. Whereas for rubella, you may need to terminate the pregnancy. And of course, the infectivity period in relation to the onset of the rash, for example, for these agents that are associated with a rash, also differs. For chickenpox, for example, it's 2 days before the onset of the rash until no new spots are present. And then we move to another problem of dealing with the pregnant healthcare worker, which is really what one does besides all the previous actions. For example, whether one needs to adjust or modify the professional duties of the worker, or whether she should get a paid leave of absence, which is really important in her daily activities. And now that we're finished with the basics, we'll start talking about some pathogens that exhibit special interest to us infectious disease specialists, but also in relation to the pregnancy status. Cytomegalovirus is one of the most common causes of congenital infection worldwide. One every 1,000 children in North America that are born with a congenital infection has a cytomegalovirus congenital infection. And most importantly, 90 to 95% of those children are completely asymptomatic at birth and go on to develop later in their life hearing loss, vision effects, or cognitive dysfunction. It's important to recognize that cytomegalovirus shows that it's often transmitted between children, and it could exhibit a totally asymptomatic stage in children, and children could have the infection without any apparent symptoms. And it has been shown that 30 to 60% of children aged 1 through 5 could shed the virus in their urine or their saliva. Also, in studies where comparisons were made between female healthcare workers with women in the general population, those comparisons indicated no difference in the rate of CMV infection. In both cases, the rate of acquisition of new infection was low. The rate of infection in non-pregnant women, however, is higher than in pregnant women, both healthcare providers and the general population. Thus, the risk assessment here is really that if you have a healthcare worker that's in contact with kids, there might be some higher risk of getting the virus, of getting exposed to the virus. There are not many studies, surprisingly, in the issues of risk factors for CMV shedding, and I found this old study from 1988, where risk factors for shedding of the virus was actual identification of an episode of previous shedding of the virus, multiple hospitalizations, probably because sometimes people getting hospitalized several times are immunocompromised and the virus reactivates in their system. Women and Hispanics, for some reason, came out of in the multivariate analysis. In the next slide, we see the percentage of children with Down syndrome in a daycare center shedding cytomegalovirus in the urine or the saliva in one or more virological evaluations. What's interesting here is that you see that when you have more than one evaluation, and actually three evaluations, this percentage goes higher. So you may need to test people more often to detect shedding of the virus, which makes studies of this sort difficult. However, these kids at a percentage that's one every five kids to one every two kids shed the virus in their urine or saliva. So I think we should be very careful when we evaluate kids, especially kids living in an institution, and be aware that those kids may actually shed the virus more often than in the general community. There's only one study in the literature evaluating the risk from CMV in healthcare workers. And this is an old study, a New England Journal of Medicine study, back in 1983, where basically what this study showed was that no greater risk was faced by healthcare workers than that faced by young women in the community. And as you can see here, in this slide, the percentage of neonates shedding the virus in their urine or saliva was 1.6%. However, when they looked at premature neonates with hospitalization, and which was greater than 1 month duration, that percentage went up to 13%. And when they compared those neonates with community neonates of higher age that had a higher chance of getting exposed to the virus already, that was up to 5%. And then they studied the annual attack rate of medical students working in that hospital, MDs, registered nurses, and compared that to the annual attack rate of young community females. And as you can see, the rate, if anything, was lower for registered nurses and MDs rather than when compared to young community females. So this is an important message that the healthcare worker really is not at that much higher risk than the risk faced in the community. So if we want to say, moving to the next slide, if we want to say something about CMV, is that the virus is transmitted by urine and respiratory droplets. The basic prevention measures are basic hygiene measures, standard precautions, and good hand hygiene. And as a comment, that there is a low risk of nosocomial transmission and that most adult women are already immune. However, in the case we have an in utero infection, and that's a primary infection, there is a chance that goes from 25 to 75% of transmitting the virus to the fetus. So if you're unlucky and you're not in that 70 to 90% in the Western society of having the infection already before getting pregnant, and you get a primary infection with CMV, there's a higher chance of that getting to the virus, especially when you compare that chance with the reactivation chance, which is really minimal. So lots of people and most physicians do not know that when CMV is reactivated in our system, the chance of getting the virus to the fetus is really, really minimal, and it ranges from 0.2 to 2%. And I guess it has to do with the quantity of the virus circulating, and I guess it's much lower in reactivating virus rather than primary viral infection. Now, if we want to give a message for CMV and CMV prevention in healthcare workers, I think the message is that good hand hygiene is really necessary. That there is no evidence of increased risk of infection among patients working with infants, young children, or immunocompromised patients. Susceptible patients, including pregnant women, need not be transferred to other units. However, we need to be careful about daycare, and we need to maintain a good, adequate child-to-educator rate. There was a paper in Occupational Medicine in 2005 saying that we need when the rate went over 6, there was a higher chance of getting CMV. We should avoid kisses in such instances, and we should be very, very careful on how we deal and manipulate and handle material potentially contaminated with CMV, like diapers. All these simple measures that I showed you, there was a paper in MMWR that evaluated the use of these measures in the United States gynecology population, and 44% only of gynecologists and obstetricians in the United States were counseling and advising pregnant women for these simple measures. So it's an important thing to keep in mind, that sometimes we face pregnant women in our everyday medical profession, and we do not advise them for things that are very simple. Regarding modification duties in case you get exposed to CMV, there's no need to be transferred to another unit for susceptible healthcare workers, and there should be no limitation in work in case of an acute infection. Moving forward, we move to another big pandemic of our century and the previous century, HIV. And I think what's important here is to speak about seroconversion and acute retroviral syndrome, and raise the importance and significance of nursing, which both raise an important risk for the embryo. We have to understand, as we look at the seroconversion chain of events for HIV, is that the virus has a special sequence of events. And the typical sequence of events for primary HIV is if we say that you get exposed to the infection at day zero, the entry of the virus into the bloodstream takes from anywhere from three to seven days, and detectable HIV-1 RNA usually is found between the first and second week. And people, we can identify this by sensitive techniques nowadays, and real-time PCR is a routine for high-risk patients, especially healthcare workers, and MONCA identify very, very low numbers of copies of the virus in the serum. And the onset of symptoms doesn't really happen till after the second week. So there is the chance that one patient may exhibit symptoms, the acute retroviral syndrome, and the ELISA is negative, and one can only do the HIV-1 RNA test since the antibody seroconversion happens between the first and second month. So if there is a chance of exposure, it's important to recommend to our patient to get real-time PCR and identify the infection at the earlier stage. Since pregnant women at this earlier stage have a high chance of transmitting the virus to their embryo. However, all this that I've told you, it's a theoretical argument. And this high risk of transmission to the fetus with primary infection, I have not really seen established in a big paper. Since it exists, though, and in theory, those millions of copies of HIV in this earlier stage of the infection can be transmitted through the placenta, antiretroviral therapy is advised. And in general, we need to know that no adverse effects of antiretroviral therapy to the fetus have been reported for most of the classes of antiretrovirals used. And most of the antiretrovirals are classified under B or C in the pregnancy classifications. Moving to the next slide, we should know that some antiretrovirals have to be avoided during pregnancy. Efavirenz is the most important one, as it has been reported and has been associated with teratogenicity in monkey experiments, and anencephaly has been noted in such experiments. Amprenavir has been associated with the ossification defects in rabbits, especially during the second or third trimester, one should avoid them. And D4T and DDI have been associated with lactic acidosis, mitochondrial dysfunction, and it's good to not use them during the pregnancy. And one should never forget that when we give post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV in healthcare workers, very, very commonly we have side effects like nausea, as you can see here, fatigue, headache, vomiting, diarrhea, which may not be important for a regular person, but may be very important and exacerbate other symptoms concomitantly present in a healthcare worker that's pregnant during her first trimester. And nausea and vomiting are very prominent sometimes during that period. Moving forward, you can see here that the combination of two nucleosides or two nucleosides and one PI, which are among the most common regimens used, may actually affect those side effect rates. And in general, when you have a triple regimen, those side effects may be more prevalent and more intense. Moving from HIV, we'll go forward and we will talk a little bit about hepatitis A. Hepatitis A is a fecal-oral transmitted agent. As a basic rule for prevention, standard precautions apply to all patients. There is an available vaccine for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and intravenous immunoglobulin is used in cases one wants to prevent disease after an acute exposure. If it's an acute infection, we may observe complications in pregnant patients at a higher rate, and this is very important. And gestational complications and preterm labor have been noted in women with that were pregnant and suffered from acute hepatitis A. Post-exposure prophylaxis should be given to healthcare workers that are not immune and take care of patients during an epidemic. As a rule, exclusion from work, and this is from studies in schools, has been recommended only if you're symptomatic for 7 days after the onset of your symptoms. Regarding the vaccine, 53% of women in a travel study received hepatitis A vaccine while pregnant with no specific side effects. Talking a little bit more about the vaccine and moving to the next slide, I will tell you that the vaccine is preferred over the intravenous immunoglobulin if you're aged over 40 years based on a study that was published over the last couple of years. And on the other hand, intravenous immunoglobulin for prevention is preferred over the vaccine for a lower age, especially when you're immunocompromised, where you suffer from liver dysfunction or when you have a contraindication for the vaccine. I'm sorry there is a mistake in this slide, that the vaccine is preferred over the intravenous immunoglobulin for ages up to 40 years, and intravenous immunoglobulin over the vaccine for ages greater than 40 years. We move to the next slide. Nosocomial transmission of hepatitis A can happen, but it is rare. There is a question in the literature about avoiding hands-on care for 7 days after your symptom onset and only for the duration of the symptoms. So there's no specific literature on that, but maybe it's wise to avoid hands-on care for patients for 7 days after the symptom onset when you suffer from hepatitis A. We're moving to another blood-borne pathogen like hepatitis B, which basically has similar recommendations to the HIV. Here, it's important to understand for hepatitis B that the transmission is basically through blood and bodily fluids. Standard precautions apply. There is an available vaccine. All healthcare workers in the United States and in other countries are required to have the hepatitis B vaccination. However, there are still countries where this vaccination is not widely exercised. If you have a healthcare worker that's exposed to a patient with hepatitis B, an immediate report of the exposure should be recorded. For pregnant women, the transmission possibility, if you're susceptible to the virus, is higher in the third trimester of the pregnancy, according to all studies. There's nothing more to tell you about hepatitis B, so we'll move forward to hepatitis C. Here again, we're talking about a blood-borne pathogen transmitted by blood and bodily fluids. Again, the basic prevention measure is standard precautions. And of course, there's no vaccine for hepatitis C. Thus, any exposure should be immediately reported. No work restriction applies to hepatitis C, of course, but people should be educated to have repeated tests once they're exposed for seroconversion, because there's this claim in the literature that if you find a seroconversion, early seroconversion to hepatitis C, treatment for hepatitis C, early treatment of hepatitis C may lead to complete eradication of the virus. Of course, that treatment is harmful to the embryo, so one should make a decision about that with their physician already and with special consultation from an infectious disease person. We're moving to one of the bad pathogens for pregnant women, but thank God most of them are immunized these days. And this is rubella. Rubella, as we all know, is transmitted through blood and biological secretions, including respiratory close contact and contact with respiratory droplets. In rubella, standard precautions and droplet precautions apply. Of course, there is an available vaccine. Of course, if one if you have a susceptible person that develops the disease and you have it in the hospital, you should isolate it. There's a special use here for intravenous immunoglobulin, and some people may use intravenous immunoglobulin in people with rubella. Again, here as a comment, all healthcare workers should be vaccinated, especially those exposed to biological fluids. If you have an exposure, you should immediately report it. You should avoid contact with patients or suspect patients if you're susceptible and you develop the infection for greater than 6 weeks. And if you're not immunized, you should be immediately immunized after labor. We'll go forward to discuss this rate of young women that are supposedly susceptible to rubella nowadays, which is 1 to 2%. An extremely high risk if you have somebody in your household and you're susceptible, close to 90 to 100%. The risk of the infection of the fetus is greater with earlier stage of pregnancy, and the same applies for the risk of harm to the embryo. And the risk to the mother is really, you know, a limited arthritis and nothing more than that. However, most of our of us, you know, modern physicians have not seen the congenital rubella syndrome. But all physicians still remember the microcephaly, the patendactus arteriosus, the cataracts, and the congenital rubella syndromes in cases where the mother developed the infection in some stage of her pregnancy and the kids were born with this catastrophic disease. I should say here that in theory, there's a chance of infection with rubella if even after immunization, and I found these two papers, as you can see, they're really old papers, that if you're not getting a repeat immunization, there is a very, very low chance of reinfection. So one should make sure that they get the repeat MMR immunization even at a later stage. Another disease that I thought we should discuss in this talk is measles. Again, here the vast majority of the population is immune against measles. The basic routes of transmission: droplets and airborne transmission. For prevention, if you have a case in the hospital, standard and airborne precautions apply. Intravenous immunoglobulin has been recommended, and of course you should have this patient isolated. As a comment, all healthcare workers should be immune against measles. And if you're not immune and there's no record of you being immune and you're pregnant, you shouldn't take care of measles patients. And the work restriction applies once you have the infection for 21 days. I should say here, I should state that if you're getting immunization with the MMR vaccine, the current recommendation is that you should wait for 4 weeks before becoming pregnant. The old recommendation was that you should wait for 3 months, but this has changed over the last few years and has been downgraded to 4 weeks. Another comment for measles and rubella is that once you get exposed and you need to give and you want to give intravenous immunoglobulin as a preventive measure, you should give it really within 6 days of the exposure. And I think this is an important thing that we should remember. Another difficult pathogen, in my opinion, is human parvovirus B19, the etiologic agent for erythema infectiosum. And here the transmission route is basically droplets and close contact with respiratory secretions. As far as preventive measures for the healthcare worker, standard and droplet precautions should be always applied. As a comment for the pregnant healthcare worker is that the risk assessment is really difficult. Sometimes serological testing helps in going forward with this risk assessment. Good hand hygiene is necessary for any care involving these patients from a pregnant healthcare worker. We should realize that 50% of our population is already immune to parvovirus B19 just by exposure and in our young ages. There is a recommendation in the literature that pregnant healthcare workers should not take care of patients with a plastic crisis from parvo B19 because we believe that these patients transmit the virus during their aplastic crisis, their anemia. The infectivity risk, moving to the next slide, which has been estimated by family studies where exposure to B19 happened, showed a secondary attack rate of close to 50%. We should realize here that patients with erythema infectiosum are not likely to be infectious once the rash develops or within a few days afterwards. However, patients with a plastic crisis are likely to be infectious at the onset of illness and up to a week later. As you can see in this slide, the risk of fetal infection is higher as the pregnancy stage goes to beyond 16 weeks and can go up to 70%. The risk of harm to the embryo is really important in the earlier stage of the pregnancy, with a 10% of excess fetal loss with early stage infection, and a 3% developing this condition that's called hydrops fetalis, and where 50% of the embryos die in utero. And the risk to the mother is really minimal with just arthritis, and you can see what I mean by saying fetal hydrops in the next slide. Where you see this impressive picture of an embryo diagnosed with that condition, where there was this presence of hypotransparent areas and fibrin deposits on the fetal placental plate on the left part of the picture, with thickened chorionic vessels. One can do some screening of when there is a suspicion of parvovirus infection with using an ultrasound or a prenatal MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. And you can see an MRI in the right lower corner of the slide that indicates evidence of fetal hydrops, where the T2-weighted image obtained at 20 weeks of gestation showed an extensive pericardial effusion with the white arrows, evident in the right in the right lower picture, and extensive ascites, also demonstrated by the gray arrows in the lower portion of the image, completely surrounding and displacing the fetal liver. And of course, you can use ultrasound in the right upper side of the slide to identify the pericardial effusion and the ascites. So there is some screening tools that one can use in a pregnant healthcare worker. Moving forward, we'll touch base on an issue that lots of us have faced in our daily practice, which is chickenpox and the risk to healthcare workers, especially those that are pregnant. I'm going to start by saying that although rare during pregnancy and with the modern evolution and the immunization of healthcare workers and all our kids, we estimate that only 3 to 4% of women are at risk. There's still an incidence of 1 to 3 every 1,000 births of congenital varicella. Extremely contagious as an agent, with an infectivity risk ranging as high as 90%. The risk to the embryo is really after the 36th week. That's very important. And the same applies for the risk to the embryo and the neonate, which is really important if you develop varicella 4 days before to 2 days after labor. And it can go up to 1 every 5 kids born during that period would suffer from neonatal varicella. However, neonatal varicella is a different syndrome from the congenital varicella syndrome, which is usually shown and found at the earlier stage of pregnancy, when the mother gets infected at the earlier stage of pregnancy. And you can see here that if the mother is infected before the 13th week, it's really very low, and up to the 20th week, it remains at 2%. The risk to the mother is pneumonitis. I remember one bad case of pneumonia in a pregnant lady I saw in Boston that, thank God, didn't end up dying. But you can see that the case fatality ratio is really not that high as most of us think it is. It's one every 1,000 cases. The next slide shows the next couple of slides show an algorithm that shows us the evolution and the consequences of varicella infection during pregnancy. And as you can see, and as I told you before, more than 90% of our healthcare workers are positive for VZV antibodies. And the risk really exists for those of us that are not immune. And women that are not immune may develop varicella with a viremic stage that ends up in pneumonia or intrauterine infection. Intrauterine infection in the first and second trimester of the pregnancy leads to the congenital varicella syndrome with the skin lesions, the neurological defects, and skeletal anomalies, whereas the intrauterine infection close to labor leads to severe neonatal varicella, which is varicella demonstrated at the neonate in the first 10 to 12 days after delivery with a high mortality. We shouldn't forget that varicella at any stage of pregnancy may be associated with intrauterine death. I'm showing you here some pictures of neonatal varicella in a neonate that end up in death, and that's one every 5 kids that are born with varicella. This is early fetal infection during early stages of pregnancy in the first 20 weeks, and as you can see here, the right femur is hypoplastic, the skeletal anomalies I was talking to you about. And I'm going to show you a couple of more algorithms. The following algorithm is what do you do if you have a healthcare worker that's pregnant and ask you about exposure? And we can follow the left arm of the algorithm, that if you have no history of chickenpox or vaccination or you're uncertain, you should immediately order serological testing. And if that's negative or unavailable, you should assess timing of exposure. And if the timing of exposure to the virus is less than 96 hours, you should give immediately varicella zoster immune globulin. And if it's more than 96 hours, really the benefit of immune globulin is not evident. And in any case, if the patient develops chickenpox, you should counsel them to seek medical attention immediately and probably get therapy. The second algorithm is if chickenpox develops during pregnancy and one develops complications or is immunocompromised, they should receive intravenous acyclovir. If they develop a non-complicated disease and it's less than 24 hours since the onset of the rash, you can give them oral acyclovir. And if it's more than 24 hours after the rash, really acyclovir is not necessary. But if you have a high-risk group, you should monitor them in hospital. You should consider cesarean section if there is a fetal compromise, maternal respiratory failure that's exacerbated by advanced pregnancy. Summarizing what we said about varicella, I think we should say that all healthcare workers should be immune. If you're not immune, you should not take care of varicella patients or varicella zoster patients. All non-pregnant healthcare workers should be vaccinated, and their family should be vaccinated if you have a non-immune susceptible pregnant healthcare worker. Regarding patients, standard precautions are very important. Airborne precautions should be exercised in special rooms and patients should be really placed in isolation. Now, talking a little bit about the pathogen of the days, or the months, I should say. I hope this story ends by next year, by 2010, the summer of 2010. And I'm showing you here pictures from the 1918 Spanish pandemic, where Johnson reported on Lancet woe unto them that are with child. And that was because pregnant women during the Spanish pandemic resulted in a high rate of death. And in a report from JAMA, with 1,350 cases of influenza in pregnant women, 27% of them actually died. But we have to remember that during 1918, there were no antibiotics available, and the health infrastructures were at a much lower level than nowadays. However, during the recent H1N1 pandemic, we've been noticing that there's a higher rate of deaths in pregnant women, and pregnant women are considered one of the high-risk groups during the H1N1 pandemic of our days. And most of us will not live to see another pandemic, but be very, very careful and cautious with pregnant women. I think it's extremely important. And right now in Greece, all pregnant women that are exposed to a confirmed case get prophylaxis unless they are at the first 8 weeks of pregnancy, where we discuss with them and they decide. But other than that, we offer them prophylaxis beyond the 8th to 12th week of pregnancy. And of course, if you're a pregnant lady and you're a confirmed case, you should be treated. We shouldn't forget that large droplets and respiratory secretions are the standard way of transmission of influenza, and that's why cough etiquette and respiratory hygiene are the most important measures of preventing your exposure to the virus. We all wait in anticipation of the pandemic vaccine. Most of the companies that my country have come in touch with claim that by October they will be ready to commercially produce vaccine. I think at that point, and depending on the clinical data we have for the virus, we should be able to vaccinate pregnant healthcare workers. For seasonal vaccines, this is a must. All pregnant women should be vaccinated with the seasonal vaccine, independent of the trimester. Of course, the live attenuated vaccine is not indicated. And as far as antivirals, amantadine and erimantadine should not be given as prophylaxis because of the teratogenicity potential. However, oseltamivir can be given safely. Okay, and moving forward to arrest slides, the guy here, the doctor here says, I hear it when we're not sure we're inoculating against the right strain of the flu virus. And taking this slide as an opportunity, I'll say that most of us remember the 1976 lesson from the pseudo-pandemic of the H1N1 swine influenza epidemic in New Jersey, when people started vaccinating United States citizens and noticed an increased rate of Guillain-Barré syndrome. So we should be very careful with pharmacovigilance of our vaccination and adverse effects associated with it once the pandemic vaccine comes. A few words about some more specific pathogens like herpes simplex virus. Herpes simplex virus is a very, very contagious disease. It requires direct contact with the lesion, and our basic preventive measures are contact measures and contact precautions. Rarely, nosocomial transmission in pregnant women and pregnant healthcare workers has been described. You can see here herpetic whitlows in the sole of the foot. Primary maternal infection in a pregnant healthcare worker that has not seen the virus in her previous life may be associated with a 50% of vertical transplacental transmission, due to high viral titers in the genital tract, especially if you have a genital herpes that usually involves the cervix and you have lack of antibodies to the virus. Recurrent maternal infection is associated with less than 5% of transmission rate. And as we all know, this refers to reactivation of a latent virus. Perinatal transmission is very frequent and accounts for 80 to 90% of neonatal herpes simplex virus infections. The kid acquires the virus during passage through the birth canal. And, of course, there is always the entity of postnatal transmission, usually via human-infant contact, which is the majority of neonatal HSV infections. As we speak about HSV, I should tell you that intrauterine HSV is mostly caused by herpes simplex virus 2, either primary or recurrent. The symptoms are usually prematurity with respiratory distress, intrauterine growth retardation, or sometimes stillborn neonates. As far as neurological symptoms, one may notice microcephaly or intracranial calcifications. Chorioretinitis and blindness may complicate eye disease. And sometimes widespread cutaneous lesions are present at birth with these kids. If you develop an intrauterine infection with herpes simplex virus, the mortality is high and the morbidity is really high. So we should be very cautious about, especially about cases of pregnant women, pregnant healthcare workers that develop primary infection. Regarding other pathogens, multidrug resistant tuberculosis is another emerging disease. It could be a threat to our healthcare workers, especially for healthcare workers working with populations that are at high risk for MDR. Of course, the transmission depends on the focus of the infection or the colonization, but airborne transmission can happen with tuberculosis. The risk is same really for pregnant and non-pregnant healthcare workers. We should immediately report the exposure of a healthcare worker. The PPD, the tuberculin, the skin tuberculin test is not contraindicated in pregnant women. Regarding medications that one can give, we should remember that chemoprophylaxis with INH in a pregnant woman is allowed. If a pregnant woman develops symptoms of active tuberculosis, we could give a treatment with isoniazide and rifampin. INH and rifampin could be given, supplemented by ethambutol if we suspect resistance to isoniazide. Some very, very recent data from European and United States conference suggest that we can give quinolones in pregnant women without without problem, and that can be extremely useful in pregnant women in such cases, and we can give aminoglycosides intravenously. Pyrazinamide can be included, although safety data in pregnancy have not been published, and people claim that it's teratogenic and you should not give it, but this attitude is been changed recently. Streptomycin should be avoided because it may be associated with the complications in the kid. And one common question that I've been facing in my practice is whether a pregnant woman, a pregnant healthcare worker, can have an X-ray and safely we can do a chest X-ray in a pregnant healthcare worker, exercising appropriate precautions and a special lead bag. And I think that's about it with tuberculosis. It's a very interesting emerging pathogen regarding its resistance to our commonly used drugs. Regarding a respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, I think it's an important pathogen that's over the last few years we begin to see more and more of it. Pregnant or nursing healthcare workers should not care for patients treated with aerosolized ribavirin. The reason for that being that ribavirin is highly teratogenic in most animal species where tests were done. For example, in pregnant rabbits, reabsorption of the fetus was noted. However, when they did experiments in baboons, they didn't see a lot of teratogenicity. There is some experience with ribavirin used in pregnant women, especially during the SARS period. And there was one case report that I could find where a pregnant woman received it for SARS during her first trimester of pregnancy, and she had she went on to deliver a healthy baby. However, we should be very cautious with ribavirin, exposure to ribavirin during our daily practice. Moving forward to Neisseria meningitidis, we all know that ciprofloxacin or rifabbing are the most commonly used agents for prophylaxis. However, in pregnant women and pregnant healthcare workers, the only prophylaxis allowed is ceftriaxone, 250 milligrams IM times one dose. Finishing my talk, I will say that there's lots of relevant legislation that has been moved and pushed forward both in European Union and across the world regarding the risk to a pregnant healthcare worker. And this is a very complicated legislation, but it is out there, and one can use it to find their rights if they feel they've been exposed during the work. I think what's mandatory for modern-day hospitals is a comprehensive written policy should be included in every hospital in the modern world that includes aspects on risk assessment of pregnant healthcare workers, and it should assess educational needs for employees and managers, together with specific individual case management strategies. And this needs to be a partnership, really, between the employee, the occupational health, the employer, and the hospital. And it should be built around the whole infection control organization of your hospital or your healthcare unit. Of course, a close collaboration with the microbiology department may be necessary, or your department of infectious disease. And if a difficult situation arises, the infectious disease consultation should be always asked for. In conclusion, I will say that finish my talk with stating that for a pregnant healthcare worker, certain immunizations are required and necessary, such as those for rubella, measles, varicella, hepatitis B, and the annual influenza vaccine. A quick exposure report should happen once a pregnant healthcare worker reports a potential of being exposed to an infectious agent. Job restrictions rarely are necessary. And for example, I showed you some cases for parvovirus B19, varicella, and exposure to aerosolized ribavirin. And a need for written policy for pregnant healthcare workers should be in your infection control manual in your healthcare setting. And by saying that, I would like to thank you everybody for your attention and finish my talk.
Well, thank you very much. And what a professional, bringing it right in on time. Thanks for all of that, and thank you for being so patient with us and waiting for the third try to be able to do it.
It's not my fault. I'm accusing the Mexicans first and then the Americans for spreading this virus.
Oh, there you go. Well, I just yes. keep saying the same thing. It's not my fault. Don't blame me. I'd like to thank you, sir, for your lecture today. Again, it was wonderfully well done, and thank you for being on time and such great slides. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Paul.
And to everyone else, thank you for joining us today, and we will look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody.